Next up on This Week in Law, Peter Midgley joins me and Mike Keyes. I'm Denise Howell. Peter is the director of copyright licensing at BYU, and all of us are going to talk about quite a bit about copyright today: Creative Commons licenses, VidAngels and TVI's legal disputes, the DMCA exemption process, stream ripping, and who could forget vomit fraud. All this and more on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 429, recorded August 10th, 2018. 1 mile of harm. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. Happy August to you all. It's August 10th here as we record. We have a great guest joining us this week. Per usual, this guest is the director of copyright licensing at Brigham Young University. His name is Peter Midgley. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Denise. Good to be with you.
Really good to have you. We also expect Mike Keyes to join us in just a little while. We're recording a little bit off our usual time slot today, and I'm not surprised it's thrown everyone a little bit. We're a little earlier than usual if you're joining us live. Thank you for making the scene with us this morning. But Mike Keyes and Peter are acquainted. Can you tell us what your background with Mike is, Peter?
Sure. Yeah. Before coming to work at BYU about 4 years ago, I had a law practice in Boise, Idaho. And those of us who practice intellectual property law in the sort of the Pacific Northwest, that's not Seattle or Portland, it's a small community of intellectual property lawyers. So Mike, who was in Spokane at the time, and I became acquainted, and we got to know each other through bar events and that sort of thing. I was thrilled to see that he was what he was up to more recently here, because I'd kind of lost track of him over the years.
Yeah, we've really thoroughly enjoyed having him here on This Week in Law, despite the fact he has a very busy practice up in Seattle. I'm fascinated, too, by the role you play at BYU. If a lot of universities have a copyright licensing office, I'm not aware of it. Maybe they do, and it's just sort of flying under the radar. What's BYU's thought on that? What does your office do?
Yeah, we are somewhat uniquely situated here. A lot of the folks who do what it is that we do at other universities are housed in their university libraries. And, the library, of course, is a rich source of information in the academy. And it makes sense that if you're a university administrator, that you would house this function in your library. But in our view here at BYU, there are copyright issues that touch a lot of issues that universities are involved in outside of the library. So we work a lot with our broadcasting folks, with our athletics department, with our various college departments around campus, including, you know, we have a big College of Fine Arts and Communications here with a strong music department and dance, and there are a lot of copyright issues that come up in those areas. So we really do have a campus-wide mission to educate and inform faculty, students, and staff about copyright issues that impact those of us, you know, who are involved in university life.
And it's almost all digital copyright issues these days, I would assume.
Well, yeah, there are quite a few digital copyright issues that come up. I mean, certainly that's the way that these issues seem to catch the attention of the content owners. For example, we have public performances of music and movies that happen on our campus all the time. And, what will happen is if a group is performing something on campus, they might post that to YouTube, and a content owner will see it on YouTube, and that's how it will come to their attention. And then, you know, we might hear from from a content owner in that situation. I mean, that has happened on occasion. So it's a challenge, certainly, for those of us who are charged with trying to educate members of our campus community that in the digital world, you know, with the press of a button, you can publish content that reaches, you know, millions of people. And so the reach that's made possible through, you know, modern digital publishing tools has obviously that's transformed the way that we communicate and talk to each other. But it also has presented some legal headaches for those of us who are trying to, you know, encourage members of our community to stay compliant with the law.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a bunch of really interesting stories to get into, things in the headlines. But before we go there, I wanted to take the opportunity, since you are at BYU, to educate our audience a little bit about the technology scene in Utah, which is something that people in California and Seattle and other sort of more conventional technology hubs may not know is really on fire. I have driven down that, what did you call it before we started the show? There's a tech corridor along the freeways, Silicon Slopes, right?
Right. Yeah. It's really pretty remarkable. As I mentioned, I was practicing in Idaho before taking this job about 4 years ago. So I personally actually wasn't really aware of what was going on, even though I was fairly close geographically. And it's really something. You've got big companies like Adobe has a huge campus in Lehigh, which is about halfway between Provo and Salt Lake City. And they're, you know, their big plans to expand. We have a lot of startups that have done really well, some of which have spun out of BYU. So companies like Qualtrics and Vivint, and Domo and others. Let's see, one of them just went public here recently, and I can't remember the name of the one that just went public. But you know, so there's this really vibrant startup community, and then you know, much smaller enterprises. I was just looking, and Silicon Slopes has reports that there are, you know, up to 6,500 of these startup and tech companies right here along the Wasatch Front in Utah. And that's, you know, so it's a very, very vibrant, exciting thing to be a part of. And obviously the university has a role to play in that. I mean, we've had a very strong computer science department for years. And I think, you know, historically, probably a lot of those graduates were making their way off to Silicon Valley or Seattle or other places. But increasingly, we're finding it hard for those to keep those students here all the way to earn their degree because they have so many offers that are local and very, very attractive that, you know, I know that's a problem that the folks over in our computer science department are feeling that they want the students to stay and graduate, but they're getting such attractive offers to go to work that it's getting increasingly hard to do that.
Right. So they're not leaving your university for another state. They're leaving to get cherry picked off by your local technology industry.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. You're in Provo, and just up the road in Linden is an interesting technology company that people may have bumped into if they've ever traveled to Times Square in New York. I wonder if you've been there. It's called The Void. Yeah, it's a VR theme park kind of experience. They have one in downtown Disney here in Southern California. I know they have one in Times Square, and I'm not sure where else they are, but they're headquartered in Linden. And I don't know if they're still doing, you can go there and experience their virtual reality stuff. We have done two of them. We did a Star Wars one and a Ghostbusters one. And they're super interesting. They're the most immersive VR I've ever done. Have you made it up there?
Well, it's so funny that you should bring that up. I actually, yeah. They're changing, they're in transition right now. And the reason this is particularly, it hits home for me is because we gave our boys as a Christmas present, a void gift certificate basically.
Right.
And so, it's been since December that we've been anxiously awaiting, when we could redeem that gift certificate and so I don't know what it is that they're planning. We hope it's something big because they've been, you know, in between these experiences now for a few months.
Right.
There's a big theme park that's, you know, not a virtual reality experience, but a different kind of experience that's being built up around it. And I think from what I've heard sort of through the grapevine, that's what they're planning to do is to, you know, launch their new VR experience when that theme park is ready to go. And I think that's supposed to happen really any day now. So we're anxiously awaiting our first experience at the Void is the long answer to your question.
And then we were talking about Slack before we started the show. Tell our audience what you were telling me.
Oh, yeah. So the Slack founder came out to a Silicon Slopes event earlier this year and was just giving a little bit of the background of the company, which I thought was fascinating that when they first started Slack, apparently the original objective was to design a game of some kind. And as these developers who were in remote locations were trying to work on this game, they were just frustrated with the communication tools that were available. So they started as a complete aside, just developing a more convenient way to communicate with each other and, you know, as a team. And eventually what they decided is that the game was not – they were not making sufficient progress on their game like they thought they would. And so they decided to change course and went back to their original investors and said, you know, that project you thought you were investing in, that game, we're going to scrap that and we're going to focus our efforts on this communication tool, which we were just developing for our own internal use. And so the investors had this decision to make if they were going to basically stay on board with this project that had completely changed from what they originally were anticipating. And the founders said the investors wisely chose to stay the course, and Slack obviously has gone on to become a completely dominant force in in internal team communications. So it's just such a fascinating story about how an entrepreneur can start with one vision in mind and it can evolve and change over time, and through serendipity you strike gold.
Our IRC chat will have to correct me if I'm getting the facts wrong on this, but my memory is that's a tale as old as Twitter as well, because Twitter was something that the Blogger team, the blogging platform Blogger, developed to communicate with one another internally as they were developing this blogging platform, and they, you know, launched Blogger. Blogger got bought by Google. And somewhere along the way, they decided, hey, this tool we've been using is pretty cool, too. Let's put that out there. See what happens. And
that's great.
Don't ever discount, I guess, the thing that you take for granted. It might be what saves you. All right. Well, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed about the Utah tech scene. I should ask you, too, do you know Phil Windley at all?
I don't know Phil.
No, he's based in your area. I think he might be in Linden, somewhere in that neck of the woods. He's the former chief technology officer for your state and a really cool guy.
Well,
really, really cool guy. Smart guy.
I need to get to know him.
Yeah, you should. Okay, so enough jawing about Utah. I spend a ton of time in Utah. I think, you guys are probably getting sick of us Californians coming out there because we're either coming to visit and recreate or coming to live. I don't think that trend is going to go the other direction anytime soon. Let's move on, though, and talk about... let's start with a company in your neck of the woods. that deals with the realm of Hollywood and entertainment. We've talked about VidAngel a number of times on the show, and I figured, particularly with you joining us today, Peter, it would be a good time to check in and see what's going on with them. This is a company that's based in Provo, where BYU is. Its founder is a guy named Neil Harmon, do I have that right? Who has had an interesting career path, because in addition to this technology-oriented company that he has been attempting to get on sound legal footing, he's also the mastermind behind Poo-Pourri, the commercials you may have seen that are pretty darn funny. But VidAngel is quite a different endeavor. I actually signed up for VidAngel at one point just to see how it worked. Its paramount goal was to provide cleaned up versions of major Hollywood films for folks who wanted them. So, you know, adult or offensive content and language removed, so that people who would rather enjoy their entertainment without that could. Hollywood has never liked VidAngel. They've never liked the concept of someone altering their films in any way and you know, trying to pursue VidAngel's core business model. But then VidAngel did something else that was also pretty interesting, and this is what I noticed when I signed up for it, you were perfectly able, using the VidAngel platform, to stream the music in its original, or not music, the movie in its original form for just a dollar, basically. And what they would do is charge you $20. And then every time you viewed a movie, it would be a $1 charge for the movie. And if you just wanted to watch one movie, you could then ask for your additional $19 back. So it was a way to sort of end run the studios from actually, you know, profiting from their own rentals, which are far more than that. So that didn't make them happy either. And VidAngel has been embroiled in litigation all along about both aspects of its business model. And interestingly, late last year, announced that it was going to offer a similar filtering service for services like Netflix and Hulu, which it doesn't seem to have run by them or authorized with them or partnered with them at all to try and make that happen. So VidAngel's been in hot legal water for quite some time now. Last fall, it declared bankruptcy to try and pivot around to this other business model where it's going to filter content from online streaming services. But the reason I bring it up today is it just suffered another legal setback. It attempted to sue for declaratory relief, which is a vehicle to say, hey, we've got an actual controversy about something. VidAngel would otherwise be the defendant in that controversy, but we're being proactive and we want a court to weigh in now, not wait to get sued in our own jurisdiction, and have our own home court here tell us what they think about this. So they sued the studios in Utah, and that was just dismissed, I think, this week, correct, Peter?
Yeah, that's right.
So they're not going to be able to haul all those Hollywood studios into a Utah court to have this heard. Anything you want to add to this discussion or any thoughts about VidAngel?
Oh, well, how much time do we have?
Yeah,
VidAngel is definitely a hot topic of conversation here in Provo. There's no question about it. And mm-hmm. For those of us who, you know, to some extent sympathize with what they're trying to do, it's a challenging proposition that there is legislation, specifically the Family Movie Act, that enables home, you know, people in their own homes, basically to filter out this kind of content, as long as they're not making a permanently fixed copy of the altered movie. So the idea, which actually, believe it or not, originated with a classmate of mine when we were together, you know, students at BYU many years ago, was that you would get these DVD players, and they would have filters that were built in, or that you could plug in on a USB drive or whatever, and the DVD player would recognize, somebody's just inserted, the movie Titanic or something, which has a brief scene of some nudity, and we don't really want to see that, those 15 seconds of that film. So when we get to that timestamp on the DVD, the player will just skip forward for 15 seconds, and so that you don't have to see that. But at no point in that process is another copy made. It's the rough equivalent of just hitting the skip forward button with your remote, which of course you're allowed to do, and there isn't a copyright issue there.
Sure.
And so that approach was specifically authorized in the statute, and there's a specific exemption that allows people to do that thing. The issue is that as technology has marched on, and people are migrating away from DVDs and players and moving more toward a streaming model, how do you move this concept into a streaming ecosystem? And that's a more challenging copyright problem. And so anyway, there are a number of Utah entrepreneurs who've been at this for a little while, and the VidAngel approach, I think, was clever. It was all based on the first sale doctrine originally, that if you owned, you would buy these movies, as you say, for $20, and the legal theory was, well, you own that movie, it's your copy, so you can have a remote with a really, really long cable that goes all the way to the VidAngel servers in Utah, and you can just hit the fast forward button from your home there in California, and the player will skip ahead. I mean, that was the basic pitch that they were making.
Right.
But
it reminds me a little bit of Aereo with the little tiny antennas that weren't actually on your house.
very good analogy. And so, there were some interesting legal arguments there, but in the end, as you say, the problem, there were a few problems, one of which was that they, to make this service available, what they had to do was go out and buy physical DVDs and rip them to their servers. And that first step in the process involved a circumvention of these technological protection measures, the encryption that the studios place on the DVDs. And so that circumvention was a major sticking point for them. And, as an aside, I know that we're going to talk about the Copyright Office anti-circumvention rulemaking a little bit later, but that's for those of us who are in the academic community, we were watching the VidAngel case pretty closely to see if the Ninth Circuit would clarify whether we have a fair use exemption, whether the fair use exemption applies to the prohibition on circumvention. And we didn't really get a clear answer from the Ninth Circuit, but we were very nervous, actually, that VidAngel, which is a commercial service and doesn't have a lot of the same fair use arguments that we in the academy have, that it would be an unfortunate vehicle to make some bad law for us. And so we kind of breathed a sigh of relief that the Ninth Circuit essentially punted on that issue. Anyway, I think the major sticking point, as you alluded to, was that the studios were really upset that people could stream these movies in effect for a dollar a piece at a time when they were not available through other licensed streaming services. Mm-hmm. So, the whole movie industry is based on these windows of time when you, you start with your theatrical release and then it moves, gets eventually on DVD. And then, at the tail end, it might make its way to Netflix or whatever. And so from the studio's perspective, what this was VidAngel running down to Walmart and buying DVDs and then leapfrogging to a spot where they could have streaming before, Netflix or the other licensed streaming services would have them.
Right.
And so eventually that model was enjoined by the district court. That preliminary injunction was affirmed by the Ninth Circuit. And so VidAngel did end up basically abandoning their original model and going with this more recent model, as you say, where the first thing they do is confirm that you, the VidAngel customer, let's say you have a current Netflix subscription or, Amazon Prime or whatever it is. And so they have not collaborated, to the best of my knowledge, with these streaming companies. What they've done is just gone and capture the streams and then had their customers confirm that I am a Netflix subscriber, so I can go in and confirm that I have a valid current Netflix subscription and now I can get the filtered version of the movie that I could otherwise get through Netflix.
Right.
This was essentially their attempt to respond to the studio's objection that they were leapfrogging this the streaming window. So now the only content that you can get on VidAngel is all content that's available through licensed streaming services. And so that's their new model, and that's what they were hoping to have a Utah court declare was okay.
Right.
So it was, I agree, a setback for them that the district court here in Utah basically passed on the opportunity to ratify this change that they made to their business model.
So the next move on the chessboard then would be VidAngel has to roll this business model out, get sued, probably in California, and play it out there. Do you agree?
Yes. Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, they obviously they still have the first case that Disney and a few other studios filed against them in California. Mm-hmm. Procedurally, that case has there's a preliminary injunction that was issued that was affirmed by the Ninth Circuit, but the case is still live and can go through summary judgment and trial and VidAngel has been quite successful at raising money. A lot of it here in Utah, even though their legal strategy is very creative and tricky and they haven't had a lot of success in the courtroom yet, they've been very successful from a public relations standpoint and a fundraising standpoint. I mean, they hashtag save filtering, and they're very much pitching this to the Utah community as, hey, this is our chance to go take on the powers that be in Hollywood. And so they've raised millions of dollars, and they have vowed that they are going to take that fight all the way to the United States Supreme Court. That case continues to make its way along. And as you say, they now have this new business model, and how exactly that's going to feature into the case. It wasn't the subject of the earlier preliminary injunction, but I think their strategy will probably be to now fold that into the original Disney case and see if they can get the court to bless this new approach they've taken. I will say, I think their fair use arguments with the new business model are much stronger now that they're not having the fourth factor of the fair use analysis is the effect that you have on the market. In their earlier model, the studios had a pretty easy way to show that they were having a profoundly negative effect on the market. And now it's a much tougher case, I think, speaking honestly, for the studios to say, well, look, we've already licensed this content out to Netflix. So there's, nobody's gaining access to content that they haven't already paid for. They're just paying some additional money because they would rather not see, the violence or the nudity or the profanity or whatever they want to filter out. I do think it is it changes the legal arguments in some significant ways. And it will be interesting to me when we get a court to weigh in on a substantive basis as to whether or not that new model. I mean, they certainly have stronger arguments today than they did before. I'll say it that way. The one other thing
on that real quickly here, or just get your thoughts on it, because I don't think that they completely avoid their DMCA anti-circumvention problem with their new business model, because streams are still protected with copy protection, right? So absolutely. In order to alter them, you would have to break that copy protection?
Well, it depends on what's happening on the technical back end. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're just this is getting into the weeds a little bit, but if you there's this so-called analog loophole, right? So if you stream something from Netflix and you just plug that into a recorder, and you're just recording, I mean, you could point your iPhone at the screen while you're playing your Netflix subscription, and there's not a DMCA circumvention that's happening there. All you're doing is, I mean, you're making a copy, there's a reproduction, but it's, you're not circumventing technical protection measures probably. So it kind of depends on specifically how VidAngel is going about capturing the video streams. And I'm just not familiar with their technology and what's happening on the back end. But so yes, they could very well have a DMCA problem, and then that would bring into sharp relief this question of whether the fair use argument they have would apply to the alleged DMCA violation. And that's, you know, that's obviously a question that we in universities are very interested in, because, mm-hmm. you know, we make a lot of use of movies in classes all the time, for purposes that are clearly, you know, they're nonprofit, they're educational, and fair use, you know, we're comfortable fair use would apply. But we, you know, the question for us is, does the fair use protection that we enjoy extend to enable us to extract a copy off of an encrypted DVD? And that's something we can talk about a little bit later.
Well, let's talk about that now, actually. Let's move up our DMCA exemption rulemaking process discussion to now, because it seems to fit with what we're talking about. We've sure. mentioned that the United States Copyright Office goes through this process. It's every 3 years, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, every 3 years, it decides all over again. People have to apply for exemptions to be able to break copy protection and use things like DVDs and other copy protected digital media in ways that will not violate the statute if the Copyright Office grants an exemption. So all the exemptions that have been granted in the past get tossed out, and they go ahead and decide once again every 3 years what should be exempt from the protections of this act. And we're in the middle of that process now, and your university has sought an exemption. Is that what you were telling me before the show?
Yeah, exactly. So we, it's a variation of this VidAngel conversation we were just having. Mm-hmm. So we're not interested in ripping DVDs so that we can enable people to stream them for a dollar. That's not where universities are. But we are interested in enabling faculty members, who've been using film and television and other, you know, forms of AV. I mean, when I was in grade school, we used to watch, we'd have a movie day with the old reel-to-reel projectors. I mean, this has been going on for decades. It's an integral part of educational experience. And so, for example, BYU has one of the largest, if not the largest, foreign language instruction programs in the country. We have a lot of missionaries here who have served missions all over the world. And so lots and lots of foreign language instruction happens on this campus. And there, you know, as part of that, it's very helpful to be able to watch films in French or Italian or whatever language you're trying to learn. So that you can hear the way that native speakers, their inflection and all that sort of thing. anyway, so films are an integral part of our educational experience, and we would love the ability to deliver those films to students in a way that they are accustomed to receiving media, you know, here in the year 2018. Most of our students arrive and they're, you know, they are very accustomed today to receiving this media in through a streaming experience. And, you know, what I used to do when I was a student, you know, make my way over to a theater on campus so we could all watch Citizen Kane or whatever. That's kind of an antiquated proposition for the modern student. And so increasingly students, you know, they want the convenience of being able to watch these films on their mobile devices, in, you know, on their own time, you know, asynchronously with other students or the class or that sort of thing. And to enable that experience, it would be very helpful if we could gain direct access and circumvent these copy protection measures that are in place on the vast DVD collection that we have, so that we could, you know, deliver that experience. So it's that. It's an exemption that we have sought to enable us to do that for the purpose, you know, it's a nonprofit, it's an educational purpose. There is a theater here on campus where students can go on date night, you know, to watch a film for entertainment. And that's not the kind of thing we're talking about. It's for education in the classroom. So, you know, we recognize that there are all kinds of performances that happen on campus, some of which need to be paid for and licensed, and some of which we believe should qualify as fair use or are exempt under other provisions that apply to us in the academy. And, So this question remains whether those exemptions extend over to this pretty strict prohibition on circumvention of technological protection measures that's embedded in the DMCA. So we would like an exemption, a specific exemption in the DMCA that enables us to do the circumvention we need to make these non-infringing performances that I'm talking about. So that's what we've sought, and that we hope will be included. There have been some exemptions included in the past for film studies courses and, you know, some limited exemptions for very specific and tailored uses at universities that we think are too narrow, number one, and too confusing, frankly. Right now, if you look at the current set of exemptions, it divides educators and students up into seven different subcategories. So it depends on whether you're a K-12 teacher. There are some exemptions that apply to you, and if you're a K-12 student, it's a different set of exemptions. It's really quite cumbersome for even people like me, who's, you know, spent our whole time, you know, I mean, there are a few people on planet Earth who care more about this issue than I do, and I have a hard time you know, sorting through it. You know, the idea that my wife, who's an eighth grade science teacher, is going to take the time to sort through this is just ridiculous. So, I mean, that was part of our pitch when we were at the Copyright Office a few months ago testifying, that if the goal is to help teachers, you know, we need to simplify this so that it actually delivers the benefit that we think was intended to begin with. So,
Okay, I have so many questions, and you have an interesting tidbit you discovered that is a great public service announcement for anyone else who is also currently in the process of seeking an exemption from the Copyright Office. But before we get into that, I want to welcome onto the show my co-host, Mike Keyes, who is joining us. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Denise. Hello, Peter. Great to be with both of you.
Mike, great to see you again.
Yeah, likewise. It's been a while, Peter.
It has.
So I'm so glad you could join us, Mike. You asked us to save you copyright discussion, and we have done so.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for complying. Lots more to come. I appreciate it.
Yes. We were talking a bit about VidAngel, and from VidAngel segued into the DMCA exemption process that's currently underway, that Peter and BYU are seeking an exemption through that process. So did you tell me that September is when you expect decisions from the Copyright Office?
I should have brushed up on that. The statute gives a deadline for when the way the process works is the Register of Copyrights has to deliver to the Librarian of Congress proposed exemptions by a particular date. And I can't remember offhand when that date is. My vague recollection is it was sometime around the end of September that those recommendations are due to the Librarian of Congress. And I suppose as a technical matter, the Librarian of Congress could change them or modify them or choose not to accept the Register's recommendation. But I don't think that's ever happened to my knowledge. So for all intents and purposes, it seems that, you know, we should have at least a really good understanding of what direction it's going sometime, you know, in late September, maybe early October timeframe.
Got it. And tell me what you found on the website that could be useful for those seeking exemptions.
Yeah, we really just sort of happened on this by accident, but apparently the Copyright Office has made it possible for people who have been participating in the process to petition for ex parte communications with the office. And this was not announced publicly, to the best of my knowledge. I mean, we were involved in the process and we did not get a notification of any kind. It was just by going back to visit the website, just as a matter of course, because we're sort of monitoring it, that we discovered, without any fanfare, they said, hey, you can reach out to us and schedule an ex parte communication, and they give some guidelines for how that needs to happen. But all those need to be completed by September 7th. So the date's coming up. And if anybody else like us was caught unawares that was going on, I just wanted to, you know, make that known to your audience.
Yeah, that's great to know. Do you know what that will look like? Is it going to be an in-person meeting at the Copyright Office? Is it going to be paperwork or briefing? Do you know?
So they are open to in-person meetings or phone meetings. They've said specifically they're not accepting at this point any new evidence or comments. So if you haven't been participating in the proceedings, you can't, you know, jump in here at the 11th hour. It's just an opportunity to clarify anything that you have submitted previously or answer questions that you think might be on the mind of the office.
Yep. Good to know. Good catch, Peter. We put some MCLE passphrases into our show each week so that anyone who is listening to the show and is interested in applying for continuing legal education or other professional education credit in their jurisdiction can show that they actually watch or listen to the show. So we randomly put a couple of phrases in that people can refer back to. We're going to put our first one in right now. It is rip, mix, burn, based on the conversation that we're having about VidAngel and the DMCA right now. If you're a lawyer in the United States, if you head on over to our wiki at wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page there. There's some information about how you might go about applying for continuing legal education credit in your jurisdiction, if that is even possible. We'll put another phrase into the show before we wrap things up today for your convenience in this process. The other thing I wanted to mention before we move on is we were talking about Slack a little bit earlier, anecdotes about the game morphing into the internal communication platform that the team was using, and the internal communication platform becoming the actual product rather than the game that they hoped to make. I just wanted to mention that Slack is a sponsor here on the Twit Network, if you were not already aware of that. So Mike, we were talking about VidAngel. Did you know they sought to have a Utah court, they wanted to go ahead with a declaratory judgment action there in Utah, on their newer business model, the one that involves filtering from streams from Netflix and Hulu, et cetera. They wanted to see if that was going to float, and they wanted to see if it would do so in Utah, but the Utah court tossed them out. So right. I guess they're going to have to decide whether they go forward with that business model and then get themselves sued about it. Have you been following VidAngel, and you have any thoughts about them?
I have. No, I mean, it looks like there's also a bankruptcy component, too. I'm not sure how that interplays here, but apparently they're doing some reorganization. Apparently, they, as I understand it, they've said they've got, you know, millions of dollars in the bank and are ready to fight. So it should be interesting to see what happens here once they emerge from bankruptcy and if the fight continues. But it looks like it's on a bit of a hiatus at this point.
Right. I know we've highlighted some of their corporate videos on the show in the past. And I think I remember we coined this term advocacy at one point. And I think it might have been about one of the VidAngel videos that was both educational and a, you know, kind of blatant plug for the company at the same time. But they're very slickly done and they do seem to be well-funded and poised to take this further. So don't count them out just yet. But against the backdrop of talking about VidAngel and the DMCA and the exemptions to the DMCA, now would be a good time to move on and talk about a different kind of ripping, mixing, and burning, and that's stream ripping. We'll talk about that in the realm of copyright. So we've been talking about DVDs and ripping them and how that, you know, historically has been a pretty straightforward use case for circumventing a protection measure. And then you mentioned the really interesting loophole, the analog loophole, Peter, of being able to play something and record it separately without any copy protection, and then being able to use that secondary recording because it's not copy protected anymore. It's going to perhaps lose some of its quality or integrity, but you know, in that case, you wouldn't have the DMCA as such a roadblock, or really maybe any roadblock. So against all that, let's talk about these stream ripping services that are driving the music industry crazy once again. The way they bubble up into existence is the music industry has come a long way. They are now posting their own tracks online and generating streaming revenue from them on various services. And they're oftentimes posted with a video. Maybe it's audio with some still images. But the upshot is that if you go to a video service like Vimeo or YouTube, and you're interested in hearing music, even though it's a video service, you can do that. And that the audio track can actually be peeled off of these videos that are available online and that are intentionally put online by the rights holders. But what the rights holders don't want you to do is take those tracks, turn them into MP3s and distribute them, which is what a lot of stream ripping services are doing. So the music industry is kind of involved in playing whack-a-mole with these services. Just recently, a Danish court found one such service illegal and barred it from operating. That one was called Convert to MP3. But there are lots of these out there, and they're a bigger deal than I might have thought originally. A lot of people are using them. Let's see, there's some numbers in one of these Torrent Freak stories in our discussion points. Here we go. There's one that is targeted by the RIAA that I don't want to try and pronounce it. It's flvto.biz. It has more than 94 million visits per month. It's the 322nd most popular website in the world, and 12% of its traffic comes from the United States. So these are not little fringe players. They are definitely garnering some interest in sort of resurrecting Napster, right? MP3 sharing. Yep. So What do you think about this, Mike? And do you think the RIAA is going to be effective against these services? Some of them are based in Russia. Some of them are, it seems like a lot of them have servers in Germany. Mm-hmm. They're going to be hard moles to whack.
I think that's right. I think your analogy to Napster is dead on. I mean, this is kind of Napster 2.0. I mean, clearly this tool is used for purposes of making unauthorized copies of streams. I mean, not only is that an act of infringement, I'm sure it's an act of in violation of the terms of service of YouTube and some of these other service providers. So I don't think there's any question that this is an act of infringement. There's probably also some DMCA implications here too. But I think you've hit on exactly the issue here is a lot of these operators are overseas operators, and it can be very difficult to go after them effectively. But I mean, the RIAA has kind of honed its approach, and over the years, over the long haul, has been pretty successful in stamping out infringing services and other similar types of conduct. So it looks like, you know, they're back at it again with these folks, but it does seem like maybe a little bit more difficult given the overseas component.
Peter, a few years ago, if we had been having this discussion about ripping CDs versus DVDs, there would have been a distinction because traditionally the CDs were not copy protected and the DVDs were. So the DMCA at least wouldn't have come into play as a roadblock. And I think the music industry would have some arguments about that, but they'd be less strong based on the kinds of copy protection that both media use. And there were some concessions made in oral argument in, I think it was the Grokster case before the Supreme Court about, oh yeah, you can rip a CD, but not a DVD, by one of their lawyers, who then had to retract that and go, oh no, we would never make that statement on behalf of the industry. But do you think that there's a distinction now in the context of streaming and stripping out an audio track that is at all comparable? Is it different when we're talking about music?
Well, I think the issues here are complicated. I mean, as Mike mentioned, you have terms of service. So there are contract issues that come into play that are not intellectual property issues. We increasingly we confront that set of issues. Just a quick digression here. You know, there are a number of exemptions that exist for universities that allow us to do public performances, and they're exempt under various provisions. If we could get our hands on a legal copy that we could use to make the performance, we would be fine. The question then becomes, you know, again, in the year 2018, where can you go and get a CD and a CD player to make that performance, right? It's not a matter of does copyright law allow you to make the performance? It's a question of can you get your hands on a copy so that you can then go ahead and make the performance without violating the DMCA or the terms of service of whatever streaming service you might be using. And so it's just a question of access rather than a question of copyright infringement as a practical matter for a lot of the uses that we want to make. But but coming back to your question about the distinction between you know, copying CDs versus DVDs, and now in the streaming context, I mean, in the end, what the DMCA says is there's a prohibition against circumventing technological protection measures. That's the language of the statute. So, you know, for those of us who are in the trenches of this, that's the analysis we go through whenever we're working with, you know, our AV folks on campus, for example, who want to make these kinds of copies. We're constantly having that conversation. Is there some sort of a technological protection measure that we are making our way around to gain access to that copy? And if the answer to that question is no, using whichever platform you want to use, then I don't think you implicate the DMCA. And so that's, you know, that's the analog loophole that I was referring to earlier. That's one example of a situation where now you may have just because you haven't circumvented the technological protection measure doesn't mean you can just go ahead and willy-nilly make the copy that you want to make. I mean, you still have the six exclusive rights that you have to work through, and the very first of those rights is the right of reproduction, and so you have to evaluate that. But you know, again, in a university context, a lot of the reproductions that we're making are going to be exempt under fair use or for some other reason. So it depends, I guess, on who you are and the purpose for which you're making the copy. That's how I would navigate the DMCA issue specifically.
Right. Well, something to watch, this realm of stream rippers, and certainly the music industry is not going to let them proliferate unimpeded. Let's move on and talk about some photo issues. You had a really interesting blog post on the Copyright Licensing Office's blog, Peter, by one of your colleagues, talking about Creative Commons licenses and compliance with them and potentially a new copyright trolling model. At least that's alleged by the defendant to be what's going on in this suit. The suit is called Meyer, Susie, English, and Klein PC versus Higbee et al. It was filed earlier this year, and the facts of the case are really interesting. What happened was a rights holder posted a stock type photograph online and made it available for free to use under a Creative Commons share alike 3.0 license. And in addition to affixing that license, they clarified that license requires attribution of the source. But they went a little further and said, not only do you have to give us attribution, you have to give us attribution in a certain way. You have to use specific language. And if you do that, then you can freely use our image. And so somebody came along, used the image, didn't do that, and got themselves sued. So the image, which was initially offered for free, now in the context of being subject to a copyright infringement lawsuit, could result in damages, statutory damages up to $150,000 for the one use of that image. Or if a court were to find that the infringement was unintentional, then $30,000 for the unintentional infringement. Or if the defendant decides to settle the case, a settlement of $5,280 has been offered to them. So we go from zero to upwards of 5K quite speedily there. And the defendant posits, actually, I guess they're the plaintiff. We've talked about declaratory judgment already on this show. The party who was going to get sued first and said, hey, you know, we're not in trouble here. Court, back us up. There's a controversy and we would like you to rule in our favor. We say we've been the victim of a copyright troll here, because they intend to try and show that this is a business model to go ahead and offer these photos for free, hope someone slips up in the way the attribution is done, and come along and shake them down for upwards of $5,000. Pretty interesting. What do you think, Peter, about splitting hairs over the way you do attributions under this Creative Commons license?
Yeah, this is a case that we wrote the post about because it'll be etched in my tombstone. You know, use Creative Commons images. It's a recurring theme from our office all the time, because as we sort of alluded to earlier on, you know, universities are huge as a group. We're huge users of content. You know, we've got 30,000 students here at BYU, and a lot of them manage social media accounts on behalf of colleges and departments and those sorts of things. And so they're constantly, you know, tweeting or sharing on Instagram or Facebook or whatever. And you know, all of the habits that they brought with them from their own personal YouTube channel, let's say, where they can post cat videos with very popular commercial music, and you know, their group of friends or family watch the video and nobody cares. But when you're doing all of that on behalf of, you know, the BYU football team, it's a totally different set of issues that you, I mean, it's the same set of issues technically, but it's a whole different set of liabilities that you have to be mindful of. Anyway, so Creative Commons is a godsend. You know, if you just need a random image, like in this particular case, it was a law firm that had used it. And if, you know, that image, if, I don't know if you want to pull it up again real quick there, it just showed the word burden of proof kind of bolded. And I, you know, it's the kind of image you might see on a law firm website, you know, pretty common. Sort of a use. And so, you know, creative, you live by the sword and you die by the sword. Creative Commons images are great, but they do come with a few strings attached. And so you should be mindful of what those strings are. Now, in this particular case, as you mentioned, it's a little bit ironic because, we get these letters all the time from photographers and their agents who, you know, want some amount of money for a use of a photo like that that might appear on a website or, you know, a social media account, that kind of a thing. I do think it's funny that they chose the number 5,280, which I think is the number of feet in a mile. I don't know what sorcery they used to arrive at that specific number. There's my working theory as to how they came up with $5,280 is the exact amount that we need to be compensated for this particular use. But they just happened to be sending that cease and desist letter to a law firm who, you know, just was inclined to fight it instead of rolling over and playing dead. And so there's definitely a part of me that says, you know, go for it. And we need more people who are willing to not just capitulate whenever they get a demand letter from a rights holder, because, you know, these things can be scary and it's not worth the time to go or the effort to go hire lawyers to fight over $5,000. I mean, there are lots of reasons why these sorts of shakedown schemes work. But on the other hand, of course, you know, they did use an image that had some terms of use attached to it. And I mean, they're not even really alleging that they gave proper attribution. They just think the whole thing is ridiculous and want it to go away. It'll be fascinating to see what the court has to say about it, because copyright trolls as a group are not exactly popular with judges or juries. So it's just going to be an interesting case to watch as it unfolds.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts. Number one, it's kind of funny that it's a law firm that did not give proper attribution, did not follow the terms of the license. And I guess it would be the modified license because the rights holder said, we're applying this license, but we're more specifically requiring you to give us attribution in this specific way. And that is an interesting part of the case to me, too. Again, you're right, in their complaint, which I pulled up, they don't claim that they gave attribution at all. They sort of gloss over that. But I think it would be really interesting if they had given some form of attribution, but just didn't quite nail the requirements of the license that were applied. They'd probably still be in trouble. Do you agree, Mike?
Well, I'm not sure, because I think this is a case that ultimately may not even implicate the Copyright Act. And let me explain why.
Okay.
There is a distinction, and there's a line of cases that makes this distinction between an act of infringement versus a breach of contract. And essentially how the courts draw the distinction, and admittedly it can be a little bit difficult to draw, but it really comes down to the question of, are you engaging in the type of conduct that was allowed under the license in terms of the production of the work itself? Or have you exceeded the bounds of the license and essentially engaged in an infringement of one of the exclusive rights under 106? To me, this is a breach of contract. This isn't an act of infringement. Yes, they used the photograph. They had the right to use the photograph. So they weren't infringing in that regard. They just failed to comply with the term of the license. Mm-hmm. So I look at this through the lens of this being a breach of contract. It's not an act of infringement. Now, let's say that under the license, it said you can only make a public display of this, right? And let's say that the law firm, instead of just putting it on its website, it disseminated copies in print. Now you're talking about an act of infringement that you're operating outside of the terms of the license and engaged in a separate act of infringement. That would be an act of copyright infringement. But here I think it's a breach of contract. And, you know, as Peter pointed out, the $5,280 fee, they're going to have to establish that they have that would be a reasonable damage calculation for purposes of this breach. And unless they have an established track record of establishing that's the ballpark damages figure that they've been entitled to in other breach of contract actions, I think they're going to have a tough time. So
Meyer Susie, you're going to have to call Mike. Better call Mike. He's got a good argument for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't, I agree. I think this is, you know, we've seen other copyright trolls out there. Remember, Righthaven, years ago that ultimately went down in flames. I'm not sure that this is of that caliber of that ilk, but I do think it does smack of some sort of chicanery here, by the rights holder.
Yeah, super interesting. All right. Well, I'm going to skip over a few of our topics for this week because we are starting to run into some time constraints, and I did not want to miss talking about TV eyes. So let's move on to a journalism-related case. This is a journalism-related case with heavy copyright overtones. So it's a good segue from what we've already been discussing. We've talked about TV Eyes on the show before. They have been embroiled in a lawsuit with Fox News. TV Eyes is a search and viewing service for video. And their target market is people who can afford to spend $500 a month to be able to search through a lot of news programming and find that particular clip that is responsive to whatever they're searching for, clip or clips. So Fox News does not like being included as one of the many sources, I assume, that TV Eyes indexes. Mm-hmm. And has sued. And they got sort of mixed results at the trial court, which at least conceded that fair use could be in play here for what TV Eyes is doing. It went up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which said, no, there's no fair use. And this is clearly infringement, and Fox wins. So now TV Eyes is hoping, they have not yet filed their petition. They've basically asked for more time to file their petition to the United Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court. They would like to be on the docket, the upcoming court docket, and we will see if the Supreme Court decides to take this up. But I find this super interesting for two reasons. It seems to me that even though TV Eyes business model is slightly different and more targeted and more narrow, we're kind of in the same realm here as search. And we're kind of in the same realm as the Google Books search case. And the original legal discussions around search engines in general, when they first came to the fore and folks realized they were operating by copying and indexing and storing what would otherwise be copyrighted material, aka websites and the things that are on them. So I think this is really fascinating. I think that it's difficult to see how the Second Circuit could just completely rule out fair use as a possibility in this case. And it'll be really interesting to see if the Supreme Court decides to weigh in. Peter, thoughts?
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, I think the fact that it's decided by the Second Circuit, the same court that decided the Google Books case not that long ago and mm-hmm. found Google Books to be a fair use. Again, universities are big users of services like TBIs. So it's a case we were watching closely. And a lot of us felt like this is the video equivalent of what was happening in the Google Books situation, which the Second Circuit a few years ago deemed to be a fair use. And so, you know, it was a surprising result for sure. And I think, I mean, the court went through, or at least purported to go through a fair use analysis. And as it reached, I mean, one of the major sticking points in the video context, which distinguishes it from text-based works, is the amount prong of the fair use analysis. So, you know, you've got you would get a 5-minute clip if you typed in a keyword that you're interested in. You would see 5 minutes of video on either side of your keyword, and so the question then became, all right, what's the – so that your numerator, if you're doing the amount in relation to the work as a whole fraction, right? The numerator is 5 minutes. What's the denominator supposed to be? Is it the hour-long program from which you took that 5 minutes, or is a segment, you know, between two commercial breaks on Fox News, is, you know, is that the right denominator? Because obviously 5 minutes will be a much higher percentage of that particular work. And so I think the court kind of grappled with that question, and it's much easier to say in the context of Google Books, hey, if you take 25 words out of a book that has thousands of words in it as a snippet, you know, that's a much smaller percentage. Anyway, I think there are important distinctions to be sure between trying to do from a technical standpoint what TBIs was trying to do and what Google Books was able to do successfully on a fair use basis. And I'm not sure with a different set of developers or a different sort of technical backend if the result might have been different. But I do think it's an interesting case, and I hope we were really sad that the Supreme Court chose not to take the Google Books case. I mean, we're happy because it was a great fair use decision that we like, but it is an important case. And, you know, certainly if you look at the Supreme Court's recent copyright jurisprudence, you know, I mean, as interesting as cheerleader uniforms are, Google Books seems like a much more important case. And so for that reason alone, I think it would be useful for the Supreme Court to take a case like this to help sort of delineate where the line of fair use can be drawn,
right.
You know, in this new modern context, like you say, with search and so on.
We have Eric Gardner's coverage for The Hollywood Reporter in our discussion points for today. And you can read everything that we've read to prepare for the show today if you're interested in doing so. You can go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We are doing episode 428 this week. And Eric points out that the last time the Supreme Court took up fair use was over 20 years ago in the Campbell versus Acuff Rose music case, the one about Two Live Crew doing Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman in their own inimitable way. So, Mike, what I'm fascinated with by this case and Google Books and considering search in general and different things you can search is if the courts are sort of subliminally adding into the fair use analysis whether one work is more creative than another. The original or creative nature of the work itself, considering books versus movies versus news versus text. Do you feel like that's creeping in?
Well, I do, and I think that's inherent in the underlying four factors that the courts look to. You know, typically, we think of creative works as being, you know, receiving the broadest scope of protection under the Copyright Act, whereas if something's more factual in nature, we tend to limit the breadth of protection associated with that particular work. So I think you're right that that does come into play here. I agree with both of you. I think this is a super interesting case. I do think there's a couple of meaningful distinctions between it and Google Books, though, in a couple respects. One, I think the amount, and I could be wrong on this, I think the amount of content that you could get, it was limited to 10 minutes with respect to TVIs, but that was just, you know, with respect to that particular clip, there was nothing that would stop you from going and getting unlimited 10-minute clips through the TVI service. So that, it's almost like you could, you know, stockpile or add up these 10-minute segments together to infringe, as it were, or at least that was the argument. And I think that's somewhat of a meaningful distinction between what the TVI service offered versus Google Books, which just, as Peter pointed out, provided little snippets of text.
But couldn't you stockpile the snippets in the same way?
Well, I'm not sure how that would work. I suppose you probably could do that, but it sounds to me like it would be far more tedious to stockpile the snippets with respect to the books as opposed to stockpiling or otherwise viewing the 10-minute clips through TVIs. But that's a fair point. The other thing that I think was important in the Google Books case, that Judge LaValle, who's, you know, really very well thought of judge in the world of copyright and beyond, he wrote the opinion in the Google Books case. He's saying there really isn't any evidence here that this is impacting the rights holder's ability to commercialize or otherwise. It's not robbing the copyright holders of the commercial value of their underlying work. So it's not acting as a market substitute. Whereas I think the Second Circuit in TVIs was a little bit more skeptical and thought that this could potentially impact the market for Fox News and others to engage in kind of subsequent licensing activities. So I think there's some meaningful distinctions between the two cases, but I do agree that, you know, there's a fair and reasonable argument, a fair and balanced argument to make, should I say, that Fox News and Google Books are similar.
And, yeah, and Denise, I
just, TVIs and Google Books, I should say.
Yeah.
I just have to say one more thing, Denise, which is I hope this case goes to the Supreme Court, if for no other reason than one of the amicus briefs submitted in support of Fox News was a brief from CNN before the Second Circuit. And in the current political climate, I would love to see CNN support, you know, submitting a brief to the United States Supreme Court in support of Fox News. I just think, you know, I don't know what would happen to the space-time continuum, but I just want to watch that happen.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I think the space-time continuum that the Second Circuit is living in is a little bit bizarre as well, because I can't see how people who are willing to pay $500 for a search service are, you know, really impacting Fox News's ability to do its broadcast television and reach its audience and make its I don't see how it's impacting that market at all. But I suppose that's what parties argue about at trial and in the record, and that's what the Supreme Court will need to sort out, among other things, should it take the case. It does seem like a pretty interesting case for the court to look at. And I wonder if we're moving toward an arena. It definitely feels like culturally, as a society, we feel like we should be able to search everything. And that maybe rights holders like Fox News and CNN, if they get in bed together on this, don't necessarily agree that everything should be readily searchable, but it certainly is helpful for people who make news and commentary and are doing education, as you point out, Peter. So I wonder if we will get to that point where the fair use considerations that allow not just Google Books, but I go back to fundamentally, I remember when people were disturbed on the copyright front about search engines in general. You know, what? You're going to copy and index our material that we've posted to the web? We haven't given you permission to do that. And courts pretty rapidly got past that. And I don't know why there's necessarily a huge distinction between being able to search web pages and other things that wind up being a sea of information that you can lose yourself in as well. But we'll see.
Just one point on that. I would say, the Perfect 10 case that involved thumbnail images. So there's another category we haven't talked about. Google Books was text-based, but images, you know, another huge area where in the early days of search engines where the copyright holders felt like, you know, how are you able to get copies of our images without our permission? And, you know, when the Ninth Circuit in that case went through the analysis, a thumbnail, when you get to that amount prong of the fair use test, you can see, there's some pretty easy math that you can do to figure out what percentage of the image, what size it is in relation to the image as a whole and all of that. And so there is, copyright tries hard to be sort of media format neutral, but there are some inherent issues when you move into the video realm that make the fair use analysis a little more nuanced and tricky, especially on that amount prong.
Right. All right. Well, I have our second MCLE passphrase for the show. It's going to be stockpiling snippets, if that's what you're doing with Google Books. we'll move on to
It's going to take you a while if you're doing that.
Yes. How about we move on to our tip of the week, which is going to be if you are an Uber user, you might want to just be paying attention to those receipts that you get and make sure you're getting charged what you think you're being charged, because our tip is that vomit fraud is out there and it's a thing. And you may or may not have run into the fact, hopefully you haven't run into it because you've actually needed to have your driver invoke this, but drivers can charge you an extra fee if you have soiled their automobile in a bad drunken kind of state, or maybe you've just had a bad case of the flu. But if you have thrown up in an Uber vehicle or otherwise badly messed it up, Uber allows drivers to make a unilateral adjustment to the bill, an extra charge that can range from $80 to $150, depending on, what the driver feels you've done to their car. Or in this particular instance, and I guess it's pretty bad in Miami because maybe there's a lot of Uber use in a nightclub kind of setting there. Apparently, drivers are charging this fee to people who didn't actually throw up in their car. So if you are a sober and or just not throwing up Uber user, pay attention, especially in the Miami region, because the Miami Herald is reporting that vomit fraud is getting out of control there. So you don't want to be charged for puke you did not do. Our resources of the week are multitudinous and are all courtesy of the Copyright Licensing Office at BYU. First of all, Peter and some of his colleagues are in the process of getting a podcast off the ground. It is called Modicum. It is less than a year old. It's audio only, correct, Peter?
That's right. Yep.
And it's done when they can get together and do it and have the resources to do it. But I assume that they cover the kinds of issues that we cover here on This Week in Law. I haven't listened yet myself, but I'm going to subscribe. Peter, tell us more about your show.
Well, as you can see, their episode 2 was about TVIs, which we were just talking about. So
there we go.
Yes, indeed. It's about copyright issues. We try to focus on those that have an impact on, educators in the university. Our next planned episode is going to be on the Music Modernization Act. And obviously the use of music in universities is ubiquitous. And so it definitely we feel like it's important for the university's voice to be heard. Copyright is a complicated ecosystem of rights holders and users, and universities, I think, represent a unique voice in that space. And so the modicum is our attempt to give voice to some of those, issues that are unique to our perspective.
Right. I love the name, too. Tell people what that comes from.
Oh yes, the modicum is a reference to which Supreme Court case was it? Feist maybe, where that you only need a modicum of creativity to be eligible for copyright protection. We hope we have at least a modicum of creativity in our podcast.
we hope so as well here at This Week in Law. We have a couple of other great resources from the BYU Copyright Licensing Office that you might want to check out. First of all, they have we've talked a lot about fair use on this show, not just today, but throughout the history of the show. It's a very complicated issue. Courts come down all over the place on it all the time. And conveniently enough, there at BYU, they have a fair use checklist that they make available to their students and their faculty and to all of you now that you know about it. If you have a question about whether something is a fair use, doing this checklist will help you at least focus your thinking and have a better idea. I assume that's why you developed the checklist, Peter.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I have a book on my shelf. I think it's 300 pages all on the topic of fair use. And so the idea of giving that book out to students or faculty member, take two of these and call me back in the morning is not very realistic. So we've attempted to distill, all of the many, many pages that have been written on fair use down to something that's workable to empower members of our university community to make informed fair use decisions. And so, it's a 2-page checklist. Hopefully it's pretty self-explanatory, but we'd love it if other members of the public who are interested would take advantage of that resource that we've developed.
And then tell us about your copyright decision trail.
Yeah, that's a more of an interactive tool, and it was developed with the idea that if you have a copyright question, there are a series of five questions that we suggest that you ask in order, and if you ask these questions in order, it should get you to what we hope is the correct answer. That's a little depiction of Y Mountain, which sits just outside my office. And so, as you make your way through, you start by asking if you're using a legal copy of the work and, whether it's subject to a license, if it's in the public domain, those kinds of things. Eventually you consider fair use. But the goal here is that the questions are phrased in a generic enough way that it should be relevant no matter if you're trying to use, a song, a photo, a video, whatever it is in your project. We hope that these questions will help get you to the right answer. And as you say, it's a tool that's primarily designed for our university community, but it's freely available, and we would be delighted if other people took advantage of the time and effort it took to develop the tool.
Yes, it's graphically quite nice and very helpful if you just want to start from square one to figure out if you're this seems more designed to help you stay out of copyright trouble. I guess both of them are.
Yes. Yeah. The idea here is, again, on a large campus like this, a guy like me who's sort of charged with keeping the university out of hot water tries to develop resources that the average user can use to help navigate these issues, that can be quite complex.
Exactly. Well, moving on to our final last tidbit of the show. It wouldn't be an episode of This Week in Law if we did not provide you with an animal selfie of the week. We bring you yet another monkey selfie. A listener wrote in with this. They are chimpanzees in a zoo. I think this is about 3 years old. They're it's funny. If you go to this video, and again, it'll be in our discussion points for the show. One of the first comments to the video on YouTube is from an account purporting to be NBC News, asking for the rights to use the video. So copyright things to think about all over the place. But what appears to have happened is the chimp has knocked down a camera that was on its enclosure and has given us a nice video selfie of its nostrils, among other things. It's pretty brown eyes. But it seemed to lose interest pretty quickly and move off. But we did get a nice monkey selfie out of that animal selfie of the week.
He's not as photogenic as Naruto.
No, not quite the shining teeth. More pensive primate selfie in this particular instance. Here at the end of the show on August 10th, we have some bittersweet news, and that is that my beloved co-host, Mike Keyes, is no longer going to be joining us on a regular basis. I hope that you will continue to join us on an irregular basis, Mike, as much, you know, I'm going to keep on pestering you.
Oh, for sure. I would love to. I regret that my schedule and other work commitments and other obligations are such that I'm not able to do it on a weekly basis, but you better have me back on a semi-regular basis.
Absolutely. So, you know, just as when I get to be too much of a pest, just wave me off like a horsefly or something. But definitely, we'll continue.
That could never happen, Denise. I've had such a great time with you and with all of our other co-hosts and the whole team. It's been a real joy.
It's been such a joy working with you here on This Week in Law, and you've been kind enough not just to bow out as a co-host, but to very gracefully transition your role to Stefan Spida, who's joined us several times on the show now and is going to come in and start co-hosting with me on a regular basis starting next week. So I'm very excited about that. Stefan works with Mike at Dorsey in Seattle.
Stefan's a great lawyer, great guy, great commentator, and I think you're going to have a lot of fun with him, and very insightful guy.
Yes, it's great to have Stefan coming on board. We will continue, as I said, to try and rope you in as many weeks as we possibly can, but we wish you well. We know that you have a lot of responsibilities for your firm and your clients, and that making 2 hours a week to do a show is a lot, so we really do appreciate all the time that you've given to This Week in Law, Mike. It's just been amazing.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much, and great to see you. And Peter, great to see you again after all these years.
Likewise. I'm so glad I could make up for your swan song. I had no idea.
That's great. Peter, before we go ahead and say goodbye to you, it's been so great to meet you today. Thank you so much for all of your thoughts and insights. It's just been really wonderful and educational and entertaining all around. You have a copyright symposium coming up at BYU before too long. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity. So on October 18th and 19th, we're going to be hosting what we anticipate will be a few hundred scholars and attorneys in copyright and trademark areas. Our keynote speaker is going to be J. Scott Evans. He's the director of trademarks and copyrights for Adobe. We have law professors coming, and we have a debate planned on the economic foundations of copyright and other intellectual property. It's going to be a really great event, and October, for those who haven't been here, is a wonderful time of year to be up in the mountains a little bit, and it should be a great time. So I'd love to have anybody who can make it be a part of it. Registration will be open very early next week. So
That sounds like it's going to be super fun. And yes, I'll echo that October in Utah is just an amazing thing. Lots of people call those the spring and the fall the shoulder seasons, and they don't, you know, you're either going to Utah in the summer for the beautiful parks or the mountain biking, or you're going in the winter for the skiing. But those shoulder seasons are gorgeous, and they're much more temperate climate-wise. You get the nice fall colors. It's just lovely. So enjoy.
Great. Thanks for letting us, pitch that event. We think it will be a great time. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us today. It has been a really wonderful episode of the show. I'm so glad that all of you who have tuned in have joined us today. If you've done so on a Friday, we're recording a little early today. We generally record the show from 11 o'clock Pacific time until 1 o'clock Pacific time. So if you go to twit.tv and click watch live, that's when you can join us live. You can jump into our IRC chat and join us during the show. But don't worry about it if it doesn't work in your schedule. Many people will probably be listening to this show after the fact, because we're not recording at our usual time. The way you do that is head on over to twit.tv/twill, and our whole archive of shows is there for you, as well as some suggestions on how you can enjoy the show on your device and platform of choice, whether you're a podcast subscriber, someone who loves YouTube, what have you. We're available on all of those platforms. Pick your poison and just join us however you can, whenever you can. And definitely delve back into our archives if you're interested in doing that. All the shows are there, going all the way back to the inception of the show in 2006. So it's fun to go back. And back then we were talking about Napster and then Grokster when it happened. And now we're into these stream ripping services and what they mean in the progression of things. And so it's always fun to sort of see how much things have changed and how much they haven't changed in the discussions that we have in these arenas around technology and the law. What is a constant is that we love getting together with our guests and co-hosts every single week. It's just always a fun discussion. We love having our audience participate in all of it, whether it's delving into the source materials that we use to get into the show or providing those source materials, which our audience is so wonderful about doing. Thank you so much for sending things in that you think that we would be interested in on the show. Great way to do that is to email me. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Get in touch with me between the shows as well on social media if you'd like. Twitter is a great place to do that. Facebook as well. We still have a Google Plus page, and I do actually see if you post things up there, because Google sends me a notice and I haven't turned that off. So any of those platforms that you like to use, please do let us know what you think that we should be talking about, things that have caught your attention, things you think are interesting, obscure cases that you'd like to see little bit more attention given to, and guests that you think we should have on the show, people you've read or seen that you think would be a good fit for us. We'd love to hear about that. We will see you next week on This Week in Law, when Stefan Spider will officially begin co-hosting with me. Mike, once again, just can't thank you enough. It's been amazing.
Thanks so much, Denise.
All right, folks, we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Until then, take care.